Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we bring you information about all things civil defense. I'm your host, Preston Schleinkofer. This week, we will continue from last week's discussion about the New Madrid seismic zone. Well, we didn't have a chance to talk about the critical infrastructure that would be violated by that huge eruption, so we decided to do a second show on that. So let's get to it. Hello, Drew. Welcome back. It's great to be learning more about this New Madrid quake.
Thanks for having me back, Preston. I really appreciate it, and it's great to talk with you.
For our audience who may not have listened to last week's episode, can you give us a brief overview of what we talked about, the states that are involved, and then we can get into the destruction of what we on the east side of that can expect?
Absolutely. So as we talked about last week, you know, the New Madrid seismic zone is a place in the center of the country where they had a massive, massive earthquake back in 1811, actually a massive series of earthquakes back in the winter of 1811 to 1812. And the, you know, we didn't really have, we didn't have seismometers back then, but they're estimating that those particular quakes ranged, that series of quakes ranged between magnitude 7 and 8.6 on the Richter scale. And you know, there were like two in December, one in January, and then the final really big one in February of 1812. And they did some damage in the area, but the whole area that was sparsely populated at the time. And we're talking, you know, we're talking the states of Alabama, Arkansas, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Mississippi, Missouri, and Tennessee are the eight states in the Central United States, Central United States Earthquake Consortium. That these are the eight states that will probably be affected by a quake in the, at least directly affected by a quake in the New Madrid seismic zone. And these, you know, back in 1811, 1812, it was very sparsely populated, so there wasn't a lot of damage there, but there was some, and it was pretty bad for the folks who were there. It made the Mississippi River flow backwards. It you know, the huge, huge ground uplift and ground subsidence on either side of the fault zone. And it was actually felt as far away as Hartford, Connecticut, Charleston, South Carolina, New Orleans, Louisiana. And it actually even caused church bells to ring in Boston. So
yeah, that was really interesting when you heard said that last week.
Yeah. I mean, and so you're talking, I think 1500 miles. I haven't actually done the math, but I think it's something along the lines of 1500 miles away. And you don't get that on the West Coast with West Coast earthquakes. They're not felt 1500 miles away.
No, they're not.
On the East Coast, because of the way the geology is different and the soil is a lot sandier, it travels a lot further. And that's one of the big problems with New Madrid is, in a nutshell, the soil in those eight states is very sandy. The seismic waves will propagate further, and it will last longer. And the other thing is, because of the geology right around the fault zone itself, it focuses and directs the energy. And I sent you a link, if I'm not mistaken, last week with that links to, I want to say it was a simulation of a 7.7 on New Madrid, and you can, if you run that simulation, you will see how the energy of the earthquake is focused and kind of directed up towards the northeast, towards Paducah, Kentucky, and further northeast, and then down towards the southwest. Because of, particularly because of the Real Foot Rift boundary. And that really helps intensify the shaking in certain areas. And then as we talked about last week, you know, we've been planning for New Madrid for some time, and FEMA and the Central United States Earthquake Consortium, or CUSEC, then New Madrid states, you know, have done a lot of planning work for this. But we have, you know, we still have a lot to go. And one of the things that is disturbing is we're not even really totally sure how often New Madrid, what the recurrence interval for a New Madrid quake is. But we have some reasonably good estimates that, you know, a magnitude 4 occurs about every 14 months. A 5.0 in New Madrid occurs about every 10 to 12 years. A 6.0, we can expect one of those about every 70 to 90 years. A 7.0, we can expect one of those about every 200 to 500 years. And an 8.0 or higher, we expect those maybe every 500 to 1200 years. But again, those are just estimates because, you know, we had the whole series in 1811, 1812, where those were all 7.0 to 8 point something. And several of them are estimated to have been above 8.0. And then in 1895, we had a 6.8 that caused some pretty significant damage too.
An estimate is just that, an estimate, and there's
exactly
really no hard science to predict an earthquake. It's whenever it happens, it happens. And so all we can do really is to know that it's there and prepare for its occurrence. And building codes can help, as well as people taking it upon themselves to be prepared so that they're not a victim as much as possible, having supplies and the ability to shelter in place until somebody comes along and help. But, you know, that could be a long time considering how much damage this quake could produce.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the big things. I mean, we're looking at, essentially, if you map this out, the affected areas, I've shared some, and I'll share some more graphics with you that you can put up. But the affected areas essentially transect the United States in a southwest to northeast line, essentially right along the Mississippi River. So if you throw a 7.7, which is what the scenario for national level exercise 11, they had a scenario of a 7.7 on New Madrid with a follow on 6.8 on Wabash Valley, which is to the north in northeast a little bit of New Madrid. And, you know, if you put that kind of seismic energy through that area, you're looking at multiple interstates being damaged or destroyed.
If you take a look at any highway map, like your road atlas for the United States, you'll see that there's Highway 55 that runs out of New Orleans and it goes all the way up to Chicago. Use that as a line to the east, and the cobwebs or spider webs of highways becomes more intense and a lot busier than that to the west, which are, you know, they have longer roads that, you know, without an intersection for states almost. Whereas to the east of that line, it's a lot more congested as far as traffic, a lot more congested as far as population. And there's a lot of critical infrastructure besides roadways that would be affected in that instance of a severe earthquake.
Exactly. And you know, you're looking at, like you said, you're looking at a large amount of 55 would definitely be affected. Many of your east-west ones, you know, you probably lose, well, you definitely lose I-40 because it goes through Memphis. You might lose some of the further north, like 64 and 70. You also, you lose, you if you look at pretty much, you know, the 18 critical infrastructure sectors that DHS has, you lose a lot of that, both in the region and some of that, either for the eastern two-thirds of the U.S. or potentially even nationwide. You know, you have, as we, you know, touched on briefly last time, you have the effects on the electrical grid, because it would, as the National Infrastructure Simulation and Analysis Center quaintly calls it, you would have a cascading catastrophic failure of the Eastern Interconnect.
Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. You end up with, over the course of literally seconds, I think it is, when this thing first starts shaking, you end up with something like 700 plus electrical towers going down. And we're talking, we're not talking the distribution lines, we're talking transmission lines. So the high energy, high voltage transmission line, you're looking at losing massive, massive numbers of those. And you, at the same time, you're going to lose 300 substations and 11,300 megawatts of generation near the epicenter.
Mm-hmm.
And when you drop that amount, because of the way the electrical grid is interconnected, you know, there are sensors everywhere. And when you're pumping 11,300 megawatts into the grid and you suddenly take that offline without slowly taking it offline, when you just instantly sever it, that causes a demand on the rest of the grid. And that causes an increased demand on substations and on all the other generating capacity attached to the grid. And it causes such a high demand that in order to protect your generating stations, your power lines, your substations, breakers start dropping. And it's kind of like in your house. If you have too much of a demand because you take a heater that pulls, you know, an electric space heater that pulls 20 amps and you plug it into a 15 amp outlet and turn it on, you're drawing more than you can actually safely put through that circuit, and the circuit breaker trips and turns it off to keep from burning the outlet up or burning up the wiring. And that's the same thing on a much larger scale that really essentially happens when you take 11,300 megawatts of generating capacity offline instantaneously in a New Madrid quake. The rest of the Eastern Interconnect starts having a cascading failure. The next closest generating station that is still online and connected to the grid gets overloaded, and so it trips breakers to keep from damaging either the grid or the generating station. And then the next one goes, and the next, and the next, and pretty soon within a few minutes, you've essentially lost the eastern two-thirds of the country. You've lost the eastern interconnect. And then what it does initially is it breaks into numerous island grids where they're still up, but then eventually the whole thing collapses and you end up with parts of it. You might only be out of power for a few hours up in Maine or Massachusetts. But as you get closer to the epicenter, you're out of power for a much longer duration, with some places in the actual New Madrid area, you know, they're estimating it could be 8 to 12 months before they get some of the things back online.
Well, that's a long time. And most people, they can't last for more than a day without electricity. I mean, that would be very devastating situation for anybody caught in the middle of that.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's not just road and electrical, because we have a massive number of pipelines that go through that area too. We have natural gas interstate pipelines, that transmission lines, not, you know, these are the big, you know, huge ones that take natural gas from, you know, say down in Texas, down in the Gulf Coast area, all the way up to Chicago and up to the Northeast. And you also have petroleum pipelines that take petroleum products from the Gulf Coast up towards Chicago and up towards the Northeast. And you have a bunch of these going through there. You've got 10 natural gas interstate pipelines that would have at least one break and several leaks because of the earthquake.
So you could have an environmental disaster there as well.
You can have an environmental disaster. You also, because you've got 7 petroleum pipelines that would probably be seriously damaged. And not only that, you've got your environmental disaster due to the leaking. You've got natural gas that, you know, flows out, because when you break the pipeline, it takes a while to shut down the pipeline, even when the safety valves go. And then you also downstream, you lose, you know, you're losing some downstream natural gas fired power plant, but you also lose, I mean, if you're taking, you know, let's say you live in the Washington, D.C. area and you have natural gas through Washington Gas Company, you know, not all, but some of their gas comes from one of these pipelines. So, or if you're up in, you know, say, Ohio or Western Pennsylvania, some of your gas comes from these pipelines. So you either have a situation where some of the gas supply for local utilities or all of it is gone. And you're talking, you know, about 1 to 3 months, they're estimating, to bring these pipelines, the natural gas pipelines, back on to full functionality.
Mm.
And that's assuming, you know, once they can get in there to start working on it.
That's considering if they have enough personnel to get in there and help out. I mean, the resources from all around the country would be heading that way, but there would be so much.
Yep.
It's unimaginable the kind of destruction and disruption and lives that would be torn apart. You know, these type of events are major life changing, and we haven't even touched the economics really of it. But let's take a quick break and touch on some of that when we come back. Hello, friends. Please allow me to speak with you about something you may want to add to your regular health maintenance routine, as well as your preparedness supplies. A few years ago, I came across an article in a preparedness magazine that caught my attention. My wife and I have always been health conscious, and we have taken various supplements over the years. However, this article introduces us to the world of essential oils. My wife began researching to find a reputable company with high quality products. What she found was a company that we have been with now for about 4 years, using their products, many of them daily. The company is doTERRA, and their products are certified pure, therapeutic-grade essential oils. Essential oils come in all grades on the scale, but doTERRA oils are, in our opinion, at the top. Sure, you can go to Walmart or your local pharmacy and purchase essential oils, but not many of those are recommended for use internally. Many of our oils can be used orally, topically, and diffused for their wonderful aromatic fragrance and health benefits. Some of our favorites we use almost daily are copaiba, lemon, clove, frankincense, lavender, En Garde blend, peppermint, and melaleuca, also known as tea tree oil. These oils have become our go-to remedies for managing our health throughout the year. In fact, we credit our oils for our overall good health. You can too. Just visit our website at www.oils4lifetoday.com. Oils4lifetoday.com, and explore the wonderful world of certified pure therapeutic grade essential oils for yourself. And we're back with Drew, and we're talking about the infrastructure that would be decimated by a New Madrid quake. The economic damage that would come from this is catastrophic to the country. this would be on a magnitude much, much worse than a Katrina or a Harvey.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be, I mean, as bad as Katrina was, or as bad as Harvey was, or as bad as Superstorm Sandy was, they were a regional impact event. Did they do a lot of damage? Yes, they did. But the damage was limited. It was concentrated in one part of the country, admittedly, you know, several states in some cases, but it didn't have a huge effect on the rest of the country. You know, I have seen estimates of some of the monetary values, and I've never seen a comprehensive estimate that I can remember of the total economic impact of a New Madrid quake. But based on that NLE 11 scenario of a 7.7 on New Madrid and a 6.8 on Wabash Valley, the estimate is that a single major quake in the New Madrid seismic area would give total building loss and damage of more than $70 billion worth of loss. And that estimate is now, that work is now like 9-10 years old. So I'm sure some of that that's changed. Some has gone down because, you know, they've done some seismic retrofitting, but you also have inflation and you have more buildings built. And, you know, so who knows if that has gone down or up. I've also seen an estimate from NESTAC, the National Infrastructure Simulation and Analysis Center, that a 10-day power disruption from fallen lines would cause $50 billion in economic impact, two-thirds of which would be felt outside the New Madrid region.
Wow.
And again, that's only 10 days. And that's, again, that work was done 10 years ago. So how much more damage would it cause now economically? And again, back then, the estimate was that the severing of the natural gas pipelines would cost the Chicago area 25% of their natural gas supply. Again, that's about 10-year-old estimation. So I'm sure it's changed, and you know, we haven't had work on that.
Can you imagine if the quake would happen again in the wintertime?
Yeah.
Chicago is cold, very cold.
Yeah.
That area with that much of their natural gas cut off, there'd be a lot of people that would not be able to survive in a Chicago winter, because that natural gas is imperative to survival in cold regions like that.
Absolutely. And you know, it's Chicago, as you pointed out, Chicago is extremely cold, and all of the northern part of the Midwest is really cold. I mean, you know, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Iowa, all those places you routinely get temperatures in the negative degrees, you know, and so if you lose your heating oil, your petroleum, your natural gas, you know, and the other thing is if we're dropping essentially most of the Eastern interconnection, we run into what they've been seeing in California with PG&E's public safety power shutdown, I think is what they're calling them. But when they're killing power to 3-5 million people, and you see in California, you know, there's no ATMs, there's no gas stations. In some cases, there's no water supply because they don't have enough generating capacity in emergency generators to supply everybody with water.
Right.
And still keep pressure for firefighting. There's, you know, hospitals are, even though hospitals are required to have generators, they're running into problems. So you have this huge cascading effect from losing electricity, especially over a long duration event, where, you know, everything that we rely on, air conditioning, heating, I mean, even if you still have natural gas, if you don't have electricity, okay, fine, you can boil water, you can heat water in your water heater, and hopefully, you know, the pumping station stays on and you still get water coming. But even though the natural gas is still coming to your heater, your heating and ventilation and air conditioning system, it takes electricity to turn the blowers to blow the air. So you've lost heat for your home. You can't go get gas for the generator or the car. The grocery stores, you know, they have some generators, but they're not going to last, you know, 10, 15 days. And so, you know, and then your cascading effect too is, well, you pretty much lose FedEx, at least a huge amount of FedEx, because their main hub is at Memphis Airport, which is toast. You lose all the trucks bringing all the stuff from the West Coast. Even in the winter, you can still grow stuff. It's just this whole cascade. And, okay, so you have warehouses up in, you know, Jessup, Maryland, that supply all the grocery stores for the mid-Atlantic state. But if they are without power for 10 days or 15 days, you know, that curtails their operations. And a New Madrid quake or series of quakes along the scale of the 1811, 1812 quakes, it would have nationwide effects. It would certainly affect, you know, the eastern two-thirds of the country very badly. Again, the further away you are, the less of an impact you have. But economically, it would be incredibly damaging.
Yes.
Certainly for the people in the eight New Madrid states, you know, you're talking massive damage. And do we have enough resources to be able to go in there and to really, yes, you're going to have a lot of people dead from the initial quake, probably 1,000 to 1,500. You're going to have tens of thousands of people injured to some extent. But then how many people are you going to lose over the next
weeks? Yeah.
3 months to, you know, 6 months to a year. Okay, so we've lost power for 10 days in much of the Eastern interconnection. And how many people die because of that? And then how many people die in the cleanup? And the fact that New Madrid is not a one-off, like, you know, Northridge, you had one major quake, and then you have a series of progressively smaller and less damaging aftershocks.
Yeah.
New Madrid has a history of producing multiple quakes. Really, what it produces is it produces multiple very powerful foreshocks that lead up to a really, really powerful and damaging main quake. But if you have a 7.8 or 7.7, that's a foreshock, and you get all this damage and you send responders into the area and you're still working, the 1811, 1812 ones happened over the course of 48 days. So you had one in the middle of the night on December 16th, one during the day on December 16th, one sometime in January. I want to say it was maybe the 12th, and then the last one on February 7th.
Well, you get people trapped in there who are trying to help others, and then they're getting trapped, and everybody, it's a mess. And for the people along the Eastern Seaboard who think that wouldn't affect us, everything that would affect them would affect us, because our lights would be out, our gas, natural gas would be cut off, our highway system would be disrupted, except for maybe the southernmost route, I-10. Air flights would be okay, seaports would be okay, but you can't get a whole lot of stuff in by those two methods, especially when you weren't planning for it in advance. But we're out of time, and we're going to have to end it here. I want to thank Drew for being with us again and giving us more insight into New Madrid and the catastrophe that would be. Civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem, like New Madrid has an example of. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with a guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_def_radio, where we post information about the many threats we see to our safety and security as a nation. I wish to thank Drew again, and thank you, our friends and listeners, who are with us every week. We really appreciate you being with us. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.